This is Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. The state of Kansas is making progress when it comes to its foster care system, which cares for the most vulnerable children in our society. But there's still work to be done. That's the conclusion of an independent evaluation of the state system, which has been much scrutinized for decades and was the subject of a class action lawsuit and settlement in 2020. The study found that kids in the system are benefiting from more stability, but some are still forced to sleep in offices overnight. Joining me now is Laura Howard. She's the secretary of the Kansas Department for Aging and Disability Services that oversees the foster care system. Madam Secretary, always good to have you here. Welcome back.
Great. Thanks, Steve. It's great to be with you today.
You know, as a candidate for governor in 2018, Laura Kelly said the state had a moral obligation to address problems in its foster care system. Has she lived up to her commitment to address what's turned out to be a very complicated issue here, Laura?
You know, very much so, Steve. Governor Kelly did campaign and run on the fact that the child welfare system in Kansas was really in a crisis mode. And our focus for the last 3.5 years has been to make improvements in that system. So definitely, I think just one data point I might just start with is just a reduction in the number of youth that are in care. When I came into this role and when the governor came into office, there were 7,600 kids in the Kansas foster care system. We're down to about 6,300, a 17% reduction through lots and lots of hard work towards permanency, towards standing up new front-end prevention programs like Family First, and a lot of other efforts. So significant progress there, significant progress in those kids who were in the system being in far more stable places.
What's the most important thing you've done to reduce that number, Laura? How do you take it from 7,600 to 6,300?
You know, I really think the most important thing has been the implementation of Families First. The state of Kansas didn't really have a whole lot of prevention programs to help youth stay out of foster care. The federal government had passed an opportunity for states to access federal dollars to provide services still in their homes to those kids and families who were at imminent risk coming into foster care. We were one of the first 5 states to take that up. We jumped on that. We've had more than 3,000 children who have been able to stay with their families, receive those services. And 90% of the youth who receive those services could be parent skill building for families, could be mental health or substance abuse services. 90% of those have been able to stay in their homes after a 12-month period, without ever having to come into foster care.
So progress has been made, but even Governor Kelly might tell us today, if she was sitting here, that there's still more work to be done.
Oh, there's definitely still more work to be done. And I think that's always going to be the case in a child welfare system. I'm really proud of the work we've done on prevention, the work we've done for there to be more stable placements. But one area of focus I think is really critical moving forward is the supports and services around some of those youth that have the highest needs. So the youth who have the highest mental health needs, youth with other disabilities in our system. And that's really some of our areas of key focus moving forward.
We're going to talk about some of the other findings of this report in just a couple of minutes. I want to provide our listeners with some context here. Even experts, Laura, with long experience in caring for vulnerable kids say, hey, fixing a massive system like this takes years. This is not a quick fix. You do it in one legislative session. There are no overnight fixes. Everyone seems to agree. Does that sound right to you?
You know, it is right. And that was really the context when we entered into a settlement on the class action lawsuit that you referenced. Even that settlement was set up to allow progress over, a 4 to 5 year time period. And even the plaintiffs who filed that suit, as the first report came out just a few weeks ago, they certainly expressed real pleasure with the progress we've made, but acknowledgement that we still have work to do. I think there will always be work to do, and I think the important thing is to, you know, always be focused on what's best for those youth and families. Permanency in child time, child well-being, those things that are just critical pieces in a child welfare system.
And now that you're under this court order, I assume that if progress doesn't continue to be made, the court will step in and say, hey, we got to do X, Y, and Z here.
Yeah, that's right. At any point, the plaintiffs could go back to court and they could ask the court to do specific orders. I don't anticipate that at this point because, you know, we're continuing to make progress.
You know, given all this, how should we measure progress? I mean, is this annual report from the Center for the Study of Social Policy that examined the foster care system, that's the report I'm referring to here, is that the ultimate gauge here or are there other benchmarks you're looking at?
You know, there's a lot of benchmarks. There's a lot of accountability and metrics in the child welfare system. So some of those are reflected in that annual report. There's also a lot of data through what's called a Federal Child and Family Services Review, where we can look at, you know, how stable placements are, how quickly youth are moving to permanency in the system, whether or not they're getting adequate mental health support.
Right.
So there's, I mean, so I think all of those metrics, I think what's also important to me is the kind of feedback that we get directly from families that are impacted by our services, from youth themselves and their voice, and from foster parents.
I'm visiting with Laura Howard. She's the Secretary of the Kansas Department for Aging and Disability Services. We're talking about the state's foster care system. Teresa Woody, the litigation director for the Kansas Appleseed, which is a nonprofit that works to build healthy families in this state, and she was, that group was part of this lawsuit, said in response to this recent audit, Laura, that the key to moving forward is investment in the system. And she said this to the Kansas Reflector, it can't be done by one branch of the system. I can't wave a magic wand and make those resources appear. I'm assuming she was talking about the legislature there, Laura. How much more money is needed to make this system work the way it should?
You know, I don't have a dollar amount for you, Steve. I think what I would say is over the last 3.5 years, we've been well supported by both the governor and the legislature. I think a key investment that we'll be looking for resources for as we go back to the legislature this session is our comprehensive child welfare information system, which everyone agrees is way outdated. I mean, this is a fairly large information technology investment that would allow all of the data from multiple systems for us, our contractors, system partners. That would help a lot with accountability, with the nimbleness of the system, with knowing where we are at any given point in time.
And do you have a read from legislative leaders as to whether they'll go along with that or not?
You know, you never know, of course, till the budget process happens, but we have requested planning money in the past and have gotten overwhelming support from the governor and the legislature. So I would expect that it would be well received.
You know, my read of Teresa Woody's quote would be that her concerns go beyond any one computer system, that she sees a need for more dollars being placed in this system.
You know, I agree. I think there will be needs for additional dollars. For example, in the areas around mental health and some of the services to high needs youth, we'll continue to request additional resources there. But many of those resources, every time we've requested resources related to the child welfare system, we've gotten a very positive response.
So to be clear, a lack of funds isn't hampering your ability to improve this system.
No, that's right. I mean, for example, in mental health, the governor and the legislature supported funding for us to stand up 24/7 mobile crisis across the state for youth, not just in foster care, but all youth. You know, that's just one example. We've made requests, and almost all of those requests have been funded.
So the court order, this has changed the dynamics, the metrics, everything that's involved in this system, it sounds like.
You know, I don't know that I would go that far, Steve. I do think what the court order did was to place a focus on what we needed to focus on in the system, which was around placement stability and mental health supports for youth. And that's what we were already focusing on, which is why I felt really comfortable entering into a settlement agreement. I think it has placed a bit of a lens and a spotlight so that others involved, like the legislature, like partners in the community, our stakeholders, sort of know what those areas of focus on those important factors are.
Okay, let's turn to some specifics that were outlined in this report, Laura, and let's talk about the mental health of these children. You've referred to that already here. The report found that the state is invested in this aspect of their health, but it also found that only 34% of foster kids receive timely mental health and trauma screenings, and only 65% of foster kids receive the mental or behavioral health services they needed. The first-year target for both metrics under the terms of the settlement was 80%. So the state's falling short here. That's contrary to what the tenor of your comments so far.
We have fallen short on both of those metrics, but those are both areas where we're making some progress on. The second metric you talked about in terms of
And behavioral health.
Yeah, that second metric, in some of our later case reads, that number's risen to around 73%. We still have work to do on the assessments. And so we have our providers under some performance improvement plans to work on that, to make sure those assessments are happening timely and to make sure they're being done by qualified professionals. We also put some new expectations in our contracts with community mental health centers. So that there would be a particular priority on foster youth. So foster youth who come into the system are now considered as urgent care. And so they have to meet certain metrics in terms of the timeliness of serving those youth. And we'll be able to measure that really for the first time this year.
Another key metric the state found improved stability in the system. You've mentioned that already as well. And that's measured by how often a child moves from one home to another. When Governor Kelly took office in 2019, children were moving nearly 10 days for every 1,000 days in care, 10 times for every 1,000 days in care. Today, that number is about 6. The target was 7. How do you achieve this improvement here?
You know, a lot of factors there on that one. And frankly, that's probably the area I'm most proud of in the sense that I think it was most critical for those youth to find stability. We put in place, some practice models for our staff. And I won't go into all of that, but kind of we use a process called team decision making, where people come around the table that care about that youth, a facilitated process, and say, how can this child safely stay at home? Or if there's going to be a placement change, what would lead to safety so this child could stay in that placement? The other piece that we've done is focus a lot on placement with relatives. When I came into this role, less than 30% of youth were being placed with relatives. Now we're up to about 43%. In a couple of regions, we're almost at half. That in and of itself has a huge impact when you think about placement stability. A known person, already a relationship, less trauma on the child. So I would say the team decision making and the focus on relative placements has been very significant, Steve.
But still, you're looking at these numbers, and kids are being moved twice a year. Basically, is what the math suggests here. Why are foster care children still moved around to different families at that rate?
You know, the place we are now, it's a rate that's measured over 1,000 days of care, so about 3 years in care. So as you said, that could be up to 2 days. Sometimes that might be.
Well, I'm saying twice every year if you break that math down.
Yeah. Right, that's right. It could be twice every year on average, right? Mm-hmm. But we also know that for in our latest case read, about 85% of our youth only had one move or less in a year. So we have a small number of youth that were challenged with placements. And those are the youth where we really need to wrap more behavioral supports. We're investing more in things like developing therapeutic foster homes that can meet some of those highest needs. So that number of 6 or the 5.84 in the report, that's an average number for most youth aren't experiencing that, but some youth are. And so we're really trying to wrap those supports around those high-end needs.
I mean, in a perfect world, what should the expectation be in any foster care system? I mean, one move a year, one move every 3 years? I mean, what's the goal here?
Yeah, the federal standard is an average of 4.4 moves per 1,000 days. So a little bit over a move a year would not be unprecedented. We, of course, would like, every child to stay in a stable placement all the time. But I think the federal measure is probably a good measure to use. So we still have a ways to go to get there. That's where we need to get by the fourth year of our settlement, and I'm confident we'll make that.
At the same time, the audit found that all four of the state's foster care contractors reported children in the system still sleeping in offices, sometimes for days or even weeks at a time. This is something the media has focused on heavily here, Laura. So does this mean kids are sleeping in chairs or on benches? Because that's what a lot of people might picture here.
No, and that's a great question, Steve. The last part of your question. The foster care contractors, they have rooms that are set up that are very child friendly. A child might be sleeping on a couch. They might be sleeping on a cot-like bed, with television, with toys, with a staff person there with them. We've made good progress in that area. I think what I would say about it is, when I came into office, it felt like it was really the default, not just kids sleeping in offices, but being driven around in cars, things like that, overnight, just not what you'd want in a child welfare system. So in the period that the settlement report looked at, we had 69 stays of youth in offices in calendar year 29. That was down from 139 and 152 the years before.
Mm-hmm.
And those youth, you've heard me say high needs kids a lot, because that's really where we're kind of laser focused right now. So we've just put in place some new provisions with our providers to have what we might call standby beds with foster homes, also with residential facilities, where we'll make a kind of a standby pay for them to reserve certain placements for those youth who might otherwise be hard to place. And then also, kind of a failure to place network, where we're kind of trying to incentivize a number of partners in our system to work together to get those numbers down to zero.
Why is it that any child would wind up spending an evening in an office? What happens? Are they simply waiting for a foster home to open up, or a slot, or how does that work?
It can be a lot of different things. It could be everything from an older youth who just maybe refuses to go to a home, and they just refuse to do that. Most of the instances, though, that we see are youth who have, high mental health issues, maybe have had some behavioral issues. They may not be able to be placed with other children for various reasons, and so they may need some very specialized care. And so what we do in those circumstances, there's like almost a daily meeting, and it's not just the contractors, it's the Medicaid managed care organization saying, what's an appropriate placement for this youth? And it's usually something, that needs to be very specialized. And that's why I'm kind of laser focused on how do we address the needs of that small percentage of youth who have really high needs, where we clearly still have some gaps in our system.
Can I assume that every state in the country has foster care kids who wind up spending a night or two in an office?
I think by and large, and in fact, if you read some reports across the country, you'll see kids in offices, kids in hotels, kids in cars, all those sorts of things. So I feel good about the progress we've made, but I don't feel good about the fact that we're not at zero, and that's why we're trying to put in place those provisions that are really around filling that gap for those highest needs kids.
We're talking about Kansas's foster care system. My guest, Laura Howard, she's a secretary of the Kansas Department for Aging and Disability Services. One other metric I wanted to ask you about, it's so important here, and that's the number of cases that any caseworker winds up being responsible for, Laura. The maximum caseload under state contracts is 25 to 30 kids, but many caseworkers are still carrying loads that exceed that. That's what the audit report just found and laid out for us. Why is that the case?
A lot of workforce issues, a lot of turnover issues, and I'm really pleased that we were able...
Turnover because of low salaries, or what is the issue there?
Turnover can happen for a lot of different reasons. The work is hard. This is one of the hardest jobs I think that exists out there.
I don't have any doubt about that.
Yeah, it has a lot of, I think emotional impact on the worker with the things that they see, the work that they're doing each day. So that's one piece. Obviously, we sit here today in such broad workforce challenges. So competition for workers, issues around salaries. So I was really pleased that we were able to to receive some resources from the legislature to provide some incentives, not just to our own staff, but some additional bonuses and recruitment and retention dollars that we were able to share with our child welfare providers. And so I'm hopeful that that will make some impact. I'm sure we'll still need to make additional investments as well.
I mean, some people think lowering the caseloads is key to the entire system. Mike Fonkert, campaign director for Kansas Appleseed, told the Kansas Reflector that if this problem could be fixed, then many other problems would be too. Do you agree with that?
I think it's one facet. You obviously want to have the caseloads at a level where there are there can be really strong and close relationships with the youth and with the foster families. But I think it's only one factor, but obviously one that we're focused on in a significant way.
Do you have any sense of what the pipeline of social workers looks like coming out of colleges and universities in the area?
It's actually a pretty good pipeline right now. Probably not. It's not enough for all the needs. I mean, if you look across the country and in Kansas, you'll see that. But for example, Fort Hays State University has done some things that have helped quite a bit, where they've created an online master's program just in the last 3 or 4 years. That's been a huge pipeline, particularly in western Kansas, for ourselves and for our partners.
You know, the state still has an unusually high number of children who have run away from foster care. The Star reported that Kansas is one of only four states that reached 7%. That's the highest percentage recorded among the states, along with Delaware, Maryland, and Nebraska. This is a report released by the U.S. Department of Health and Senior Services Office of the Inspector General. Why so many missing children?
You know, in terms of the youth who run, you know, Kansas in that report did show up at a high level. I could argue about the data and say there's a little bit of apples and oranges because I think we report in a very comprehensive way. But the fact is, I think the important piece is what we're doing about that. And we've continued to invest in special response teams where we have targeted staff across all of our providers who are building relationships with those youth. And for example, I'd really call out TFI, who's one of our case management providers. They've had several periods where they've ended up with actually no youth on the run, and they actually just worked with the University of Kansas to do a study of why youth run and what those facets are, and some very interesting things that we can build on there. For example, the importance of maintaining relationships with siblings. Very often, they talked about the desire to see their siblings. They're often running home. Not always, but often. And so just some facets there where I think we can really learn a lot from that study and from some of the work that one of our providers has done. So we're trying to spread those lessons learned across the system, Steve.
Again, what else do we know about why kids run away from foster care? What's going on there?
Like I said, the majority of kids, I mean, they're running home. I think is really important is In my view, the reason kids run is that they don't feel that they have a strong relationship, a strong bond with someone. And that's a bit why we've created the special response team. I think we know that when youth feel like they have particular bonding with an individual, with a person, with a mentor, with anything like that, they're far less likely to run.
Well, let's go to some phone calls here. Let's go to Eileen from Ottawa. Eileen, you're on Up to Date with Laura Howard. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I am an older returning adult student. I'm an undergrad at Washburn, social work major, and I will be going into a macro program for my master's degree. And one thing that I get really frustrated with is I feel like so many people blame the system and the people in the system when the reality of it is there's a couple things going on. For one thing, the legislature doesn't fund enough. There's not enough funding for social services. And everybody from the social workers and community health centers and homes and things like that, all the way down to healthcare aides, need to be paid a living wage.
Laura, you said that you think the funding from the legislature is adequate. What about the salaries being paid to some of the key players here?
Oh, I think definitely there's progress to be made on salaries. That's why I mentioned kind of the funding for retention bonuses and things like that. But I think we'll need to continue to invest in higher salaries. And I would say, might comment on one thing that Eileen said when she was
just
talking
quickly,
about
I got about
funding.
20 seconds.
Yeah. I think the lack of funding for the basic safety net services, the continued impact of some of the restrictions on safety net services in the state, I mean, that is an area of funding where I would like to see the legislature move back to how that used to look, because that does impact the number of youth coming into care and families in crisis.
Okay, that's Laura Howard. She oversees a very important service for the state of Kansas, and that it's foster care system. She's the secretary of the Kansas Department for Aging and Disability Services. Laura, thanks so much. Much appreciated.
Thank you, Steve.
Up to Date is a production of KCUR 89.3. Our theme music was composed by the great Bobby Watson. The program is produced by Danny Alexander, Zach Wilson, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Reginald David. Our engineer is Paul Nakatura. I'm Steve Kraske. Thanks for listening.